hold on to it, even as I hold on to this. Welcome and thank you for coming out to hear about my book. It's all good. I just have to keep it right there in the zone, in the cone of not indifference. This is outside the cone. This is in the cone. As Ruri said, my name is Yael Kirshner. It means so much to me to have my first speaking event for this book here at the St. Pete Museum of History. Right? This place is an institution. It is a repository of so much learning and history and culture that is ours. And I feel that outside of Florida, people don't think of Florida as having a rich cultural tradition, and I love being one of the voices that says, oh, wait a minute, that's not right. And, this is what Florida Girls is, but it's also completely an invention of my own. So I'm going to talk to you tonight a little bit about the true stories that informed the book. It is a story of a team of touring swimsuit models out of St. Petersburg, that was a real thing, that went on a war bond tour during World War II. That part I invented, although they were actually active and traveling at that time. It was organized by Webb City. I'm sure everyone in this room has heard of Webb City. You're in for a treat. About a little bit more soon. But in the book, it's called Sun City Emporium, and it's a giant downtown drugstore that is famous for live mermaid shows, dancing chickens. They have everything from, painted, they do hosiery painting to haircuts to having a little diner inside. And my favorite, because my parents own the gym, is the Forever Young tincture that Lloyd Young, Lloyd Doc Young sold. He made it for 29 cents and he sold it for $1.99. So even on half off sale, they were making a profit. Anyway, that was Sun City Emporium, modeled on Webb City, but not the same place at all, because in Sun City Emporium, the Tampa Mafia has their hooks in deep. Now, the Tampa Mafia absolutely had their hooks into a lot of businesses in the area at the time. I frankly don't have any idea if they had anything to do with Webb City, but for the purposes of this book, they're in deep with Sun City. And I think that is a good sort of warm up about the book to tell you a little bit about that. I have notes here. I have to say, another reason this means so much to me, and Ruri, so great. I mean, I wrote to him and he just got back right away. He was like, whoa, this book, I love it. And I did so much research, and so to get to share it, because most of what I'm going to tell you tonight is not on the page. This is the hours and hours that I spent doing this research, and it's okay, so I had to cut, but I'm excited to tell you all about it because you are lovers of history, and maybe for some of the same reasons that I am. So, right? I came across a photograph of these women clad in these 1940s era bathing suits with 1940, this is not the photo, by the way, and I thought to myself, wait a minute, 1940s, weren't we at war? Weren't we rationing sugar, butter, meat, coffee, and most importantly, tires and gasoline? Yes, we were. In fact, there were huge propaganda campaigns that were aimed at getting people not to travel. So what kind of hustler could have possibly made that happen? And how was it really possible that Florida was doing these tours? This is the photograph that I saw. I know, right? This is the Florida Girls and the California Girls are lined up on a pool right here. Over here, they're in a scuffle. I have to read this quote for you because it's too good not to, so let me get my readers out so I can tell you. Just in case you thought that photo of the girls in the high heels getting onto the bus was a photo op, oh no. So here's the quote, and that's what it says up at the top. I'm not really sure where this actually is clipped from, but I do know that these photos, when I research it later, they were taken in 1946 for Life magazine. But the photos went everywhere, not just Life magazine. That's how photographers, make money. Anyway, here's the quote. All this was, of course, a big publicity stunt for the poster girls, a busty contingent of teenagers hired by G.E. Doc Webb of St. Petersburg to model the latest fashions at his drugstore. The eight girls were selected from some 300 that he trains and models in order, he says, to lessen juvenile delinquency. Just leave that there. You can see why I had to do that. Anyway, whatever you think about that, again, I still, even though this was taken in 1946, when I first saw it, I didn't quite realize that, but when I found the poster girls, I did find that indeed they had traveled in World War II. And I don't know the extent of their travel in that time, but meet John Lodwick. How many of you have heard of John Lodwick? What? Oh my gosh, you are going to love this story. Well, I see you all in the back. You better have heard of John Lodwick back there. So John Lodwick was the promotional mastermind. I think that's so funny because this was one of the first stories that I heard when I came to St. Pete, and I never forgot it, because he was famous for putting together promotional campaigns that attracted tourists to come to the city. He moved here in 1918 from Cleveland, Ohio, because, same reason most of us came here, hated the cold. He absolutely hated the cold. He loved St. Petersburg so much, not Tampa, not Florida, St. Petersburg, so much that he volunteered to take photographs of snowbirds outside and join winter activities like shuffleboard and frolicking so that he could send them back to the hometown papers and then attract more people to come. It was so successful, the city hired him, of course, and he went on to be a city promoter, I think until the end of his life. Yeah. I mean, he actually died on a streetcar. I don't know if he was still promoting the city at the time. Anyway, he was young. He was like 50-something. One of his campaigns that I really loved is this one. Did you guys know that we used to have a nude spa in downtown? I know Rui knows. We used to have a municipally operated solarium for curative powers, for healing, for health, vitality. And guess who promoted the sun as healing, healthful, and part of vitality? Well, heliotherapy is what he called it. Now, that existed before John Lodwick got a hold of it, but he commissioned a St. Pete physician to write an essay called The Curative Value of Sunshine or something like that. And the essays were printed wide-ranging, and it was something that, what I understand, it sounded better on a prescription pad than nude sunbathing. So you could get a prescription to take your curative sun down in St. Petersburg, Florida. It was so popular, even hotels put little rooftop solariums where people could go. It was basically a structure without a roof. And they would lie nude in there. They had towel service at the municipal solarium. All you needed to do was cover your eyes from the glare, according to these studies. He actually promoted this campaign for many, many years, including this 1936 photo shoot with Sally Rand. Sally Rand was a fan dancer who he hired to frolic all the way to the solarium nude. I'm saying nude with air quotes because you can see she's wearing a flesh-colored leotard. I don't know if they saw that then. They saw Sally Rand, the infamous fan dancer, frolicking into the solarium. But this is his most famous campaign of all. We must protect the merry men in the wilds of the sea vamp. You will not believe John Lodwick in 1922, he and Mayor Frank F. Pulver, I love that F because his middle name was Fortune, or probably Italian, so it was probably Fortuna. But anyway, he and Frank Pulver got together and they created a purity league that was supposedly scandalized by the teeny tiny bathing costumes that these sea vamps were wearing on St. Pete's beaches. They sent outraged editorials across the country. I gotta show you this picture. This is a full page spread in the Sunday, San Francisco Examiner, right? I want to read something else to you, a little quote from in here, because And again, this is one of those things that I think we all love about history. One of the reasons that I love it is because you discover how long we've been fighting the same battles. Here is a quote. So this is one of the young women quoted in the article. "Nowadays, we do real hard athletic work in our water sports. Grandmother used to cover herself up from her toes to her chin and walk down and step timidly into the water and splash around for a while and then go out and call it sea bathing. Now things have changed. We go in for real athletic sports. We swim, dive, play water polo, and all sorts of stunts. It can't be done with skirts and pantyhose, water-soaked pantyhose, sorry, and bathing shoes. This is what the women of the league that was invented don't seem to grasp." I don't know if they, but you know, isn't that what kids always say? Oh, you don't get it. Now, something that I think is different in this article, you see here, this is Mayor Culver in his white linen suit and his strong ruler, described as the eligible young bachelor mayor of St. Petersburg. I don't know if you can tell from this photo, but he's 52. I would like for those times to come back. Thank you very much. Anyway, fun and frolicking, however, weren't the only influences at play in Tampa Bay in the 40s. These are Belita balls. How many of you guys know what Belita balls are? Yes, yes, yes. Well, you read the book. So Belita is a gambling game that was brought over from Cuba in the 1880s. And these are 100 numbered balls. I love these. They look like they're hand-painted, right? You put them into a sack, you pull out the winning numbers, voila. If it looks familiar, that's because it is. It's the precursor to the modern lottery, which we all know and love. As popular as the lottery is, it was that popular as Belita. And, I want to stay here for one more minute. Obviously, lots of corruption could come in. You could get into this game for as little as pennies, right? You could make a penny bet, and you could hit it big. That's the dream, right? And it's also, they could freeze the balls, hollow them out. They did all kinds of things to hit certain numbers. And this, of course, attracted the attention of the mafia. So by the 1920s, they had taken it over from Cuban operators, which will come into play in my book. You'll see it so much in Florida Girls, you'll see it in Havana Girls. That's the third book in the series. Anyway, the major players in the game were Charlie Wall, the blue-blooded orphan out of Tampa, who may have shot his mom, maybe he shot the cook. He ended up in juvenile detention, and then he got kicked out of military school before he went into the numbers racket and really started being as ruthless as he is. And he was up against Ignacio Antinori, who was straight out of Sicily. He was a classic Italian gangster trained by the classic mafia types, right? They were very different but equally powerful, and this ushered in what was known as the Era of Blood. This was in the 20s, 30s. Some 25 gangsters were shot and killed on the streets of Tampa during this Era of Blood. Now, in my book, I call this era the Belita Wars, mostly because I needed to come up with facts that would suit the plot, but it really follows the same kind of cronyism and, foul play that typified the era. So, this is where the Traficantes come in, right? We all know the Traficantes, yes?
Yes.
No? Traficantes, major crime family in Tampa. And they got started in Prohibition. And then, of course, when Prohibition ended with the war, they had to sort of get busy with Belita because they wanted to make that big money. And that was an illegal game that they could make big money in. Now, Antinori, he was also a heroin trafficker. Wall was mostly into, heroin in the 30s, and his main pipeline was to the Midwest. He brought it from Cuba, shipped it out to, Chicago and Missouri. And so anyway, when the Era of Blood ended, it was because Antinori was murdered. And his protege was actually Santo Travancante. See, here we have Senior and Junior. Senior has the little teeny total mobster guy tie, and next to him is Junior. This is an undated family photo. But anyway, they kind of took over Antinori's place in the Bolita world. And basically, they told Charlie Wall, okay, we will not kill you, but you got to get out of the numbers game, which he did. So they must have been really scary, because Wall had not backed down from anyone before then. Anyway, this is the page. This family appears in the book as the Giancarlos. The similarities kind of end with the fact that they're Italian. I mean, in my book, the family patriarch Salvatore, he grew up, he also was born in Italy, just like Santo Travancante. He is disappointed in his son, although the jury's a little bit out with Santo. But anyway, his son ends up taking over. That's not what happens in my book. And then, I have to finish this about the Travancantes and the Giancarlos. So when the Giancarlos get to meet the other difference is that the rival of Sal Giancarlo is his brother. It's not it's not another gangster, right? So anyway, you remember Charlie Wall, he's still out there. The other thing about the Travancantes is that, you know, they hated Charlie Wall, and he, even though he stepped aside, it did not mean he didn't have any way to hurt them any longer. In 1950, the Kefauver Committee came along. Have you all heard about the Kefauver Committee? Yes. So Senator S.S. Kefauver in 1951 held a series of 14 trials across the country, and those trials were basically putting organized crime on trial. Because what happened during the 40s? We were at war. The government was busy fighting the Axis powers, and organized crime was having a field day all across the country. So in 1950, this SS Kefauver gets serious about trying to combat it, and they come to Tampa. They talk to Charlie Wall. Charlie Wall battles like a brook. He can't wait to talk about his exploits as a youngster because he's been pushed out of the game. And this is why it's believed that he was likely assassinated by Santo Travancante. Although, ultimately, that assassination, which didn't happen until 1955, was over money, because it was right after Travancante Jr., Santo was dead, the senior, had been forced to pay back taxes. About a month after that, he's found assassinated with birdseed. I mean, I don't know. It seems pretty obvious to me. Anyway, the feds needed more than just the cooperation of Charlie Wall, however. Right here we have Lucky Luciano. Who's heard of Lucky Luciano? Everybody? Who hasn't heard of Lucky Luciano? Okay. So he was a gangster who operated out of Chicago. And the belief is that he was part of putting the hit out on Antinori, if we go back to our gangsters, because Antinori had shipped him some inferior product. Anyway, he's in jail at this point, also for tax evasion, when the war is happening, World War II. And the other thing that's going on is the government is looking at national security, because even though the war is being fought in Europe, remember, we got the war because of Pearl Harbor. Well, New York was then our major port for war goods. And at that time, it was run by the Italian mafia. Most everybody who worked on the docks was Italian. In 1941, Italy was part of the Axis powers. So that was a real threat. And most of the people who were in the government trying to secure the port had also worked with Thomas Dewey. So Thomas Dewey was the special prosecutor that did things like put Lucky Luciano behind bars. So anyway, we get to this point. The cooperation of the underworld is not certain, but he's able to get Luciano to agree. And they love to say how they didn't do anything to get this cooperation. Not true. What they did was they gave him unmonitored visits with his associates. So, and they then proceeded to speak in Italian, which nobody around them understood. So he was basically running his business from jail. It was very business as usual for Lucky. But the government really did need their help because the port was not the only place that there were vulnerabilities. Although this is a photograph from the trial of Operation Pistorius. Now, I had never heard of this until I started researching this book. Operation Pistorius was actually the name of a German operation where U-boats, the plan was they would come to this country, they would infiltrate ports in New York and Florida, and there are actually stories of people who saw the U-boats coming, who've seen U-boats. Anyway, they came, the idea was they were going to come over, loaded down with explosives, and then disable the production of war goods, things like the New York waterway, transit systems. Well, that didn't happen. And the feds touted it as a major victory. The reason it didn't happen? Because the head of the German operation secretly wished that he could live in America, and he thought if he turned in this operation, he would get his wish. Well, this is what he got. but again, it showed the government that they had a kind of vulnerability. There were some serious vulnerabilities, because if it weren't for that sort of random luck, they had made it all the way into the States with these explosives. So in my book, I create a later war threat. So toward the end of the war, there's another threat. But because Sal Giancarlo is enemies with Lucky Luciano, he doesn't want to cooperate with the feds. And the feds, frankly, don't have anything to offer him. He's not in jail. He doesn't need their money. So they go after the owners of the Sun City Emporium. All those poor Sun City Emporium people, they just get it from every angle. This is the stew. Look at these ladies. I had to put this scene. When I came across this photo, I was like, I have to put this scene in there. Because, of course, what do we know is very enmeshed with the mafia. Unions, trash operations. I don't understand why trash operations, but there you have it. Anyway, this was when they were opening these sanitation trucks. And I thought, what a fantastic way to kind of really show the Sun City girls, or AKA the Florida girls, exactly what their place is in the hierarchy. They don't really care. Oh, one more thing. So in order to get, even though my characters are entirely fictional, and one thing you'll have noticed, all of this talking I've been doing has been about these men, right? And when I started to write this book, I was going to write sort of a story about the men, you know, some of the women too, sure, whatever. But I was very fascinated by these characters, and that's because that's what we get in the history books. We don't really hear the stories of women from that era at all. And I wanted to give these characters the same kind of authenticity that I could give to, say, events and other forces at work. And so I wanted to give them some real life mentors, and that's when I came across Madame Stephanie St. Clair. Who has anybody heard of? I had never heard of her before I started doing the research for this book. She is quite a character. She outwitted the mob at the numbers racket in New York City for decades. She was a black woman, right? And she came over in, I think it was 1912 in the West Indies, and she very quickly realized if you're black in the US in 1912, the only way to make money is illegally, so she started selling drugs. Within a matter of months, she had accumulated enough money to start bribing policemen and opening these clandestine lottery games in New York City. So she's got this going. She's in New York. She is doing that whole thing, and they are, I give her an opportunity to meet with Thelma to help her understand that she has some powers with the mom. Then I thought, well, everybody knows who this is. Virginia Hill. Have you guys heard of Virginia Hill? No? She's one of the most famous mob malls that there is. She was the girlfriend of Bugsy Siegel. Bugsy Siegel is not photoed here. She's photographing unnamed arm candy, which how often do you see that? Especially in those days, right? It's like, usually it's like this guy and this guy and their lady friend, right? Anyway, Virginia Hill definitely did things her own way. She was not afraid to use her sex appeal to rise as a mob courier. And she was very, I like to call her the Stormy Daniels of her time, because she too, although she stonewalled, she was no Stormy. She didn't have that kind of bravery, but she gave very saucy testimony before the Defalver Committee. And in fact, her saucy testimony impacts me to this day, because I present products for the Home Shopping Network, which you all know, and there's a delay in live broadcast, so that someone can't say the things that she said live on national TV in 1950 without being bleeped or censored out in some way, because the FCC requires you to adhere to the decency standards, right? So anyway, she was quite a character, and I wanted her to sort of... So Thelma, broke, orphaned, alone, this is how she shows up in St. Petersburg. She's desperate to escape her criminal past. Oops, she has stepped into the mafia's lair. And she is still trying to escape her past when she meets this Virginia Hill, who kind of says, there may be some things about your past that you can use to your advantage. Just think about that. So another thing that every hero needs is a funny gang segment, right? This is Sophie Tucker. She was the last of the Red Hot Mamas. She came up as a vaudevillian in the, she had a 62-year career that spanned from the teens up until the 60s. She was booked for 2 years solid after she died. She had a very brash style. She wore flamboyant dresses, and she made jokes about men and sex and her full figure in her songs. She was sort of like an early rapper. I think if she lived today, she would have gone in the rap way. Anyway, she appears briefly in a scene with Thelma and Salvatore Giancarlo when they're in Vegas, because she's a Vegas entertainer, which sort of plants this, it plants a number of scenes in Thelma's mind, but not the least of which is, because Thelma, although she's gotten onto this Florida girl team, she's not really sure why, because she's not a great singer and she's not a great dancer. So I'll just leave that mystery for all of you to find out. What? Anyway, so that is the stew that kind of made up the book. We had the swimsuit moms, we had the Tam Mafia, we had the government officials. And what really holds it together for me are these stories of women. Like I said, you look at that whole era, and there are these famous stories about men, the Trafficantes, the John Lodwicks, and right now there is an exhibition here about the women, the very spicy women who helped to found this city. And when you start to dig even a little bit, you find very interesting stories. And so I just put together one set of possibilities. The QR code there goes to my newsletter. Right now I'm doing research for Vegas Girls, which is the second book in the trilogy, and also for Havana Girls, which will be the third book. I call them the Queen Pin Chronicles. So I'm looking for stories of these interesting women. And I find, because you just saw lots of information, you've read the book, none of that's in the book. But it informs what's going on in the book, right? You have to know all of these things. So it's thrilling to talk to people who love history. And like Rui said, it's called Ill-Behaved Women. And as I like to say, that's because history is already littered with the stories of well-behaved women. So, thank you. Who has questions? I can just bring the mic right to you. Yes.
Never mind. So the next two books are, do they connect?
Yes.
So Florida gets you to Las Vegas, gets you to Havana,
yes.
Same time period? What?
So
The next book, Vegas Girls, it happens at the end of Florida Girls. And one of the reasons that I had to go to Vegas was because when I started doing this research, I recognized, A, that is where the mafia was also really taking root, and B, I imagine this at first was going to be a standalone book, but these girls had a lot more to say to me. And because there were so many issues, women's lives were changing irreversibly because of the events that happened during the war. And there were so many different responses to it, and I really wanted to write into that. So the second book is, in some ways, it's much more thriller-like. It happens over the course of a very short period of time. It's a lot of fast action. And then the third book is going to be a long view of things that happened, because one of the characters from Florida Girls, I won't say which one, but she surfaces and starts doing some research later, when at a time of the Muriel Boat Lift, so when Cuban immigration was a thing. So, I mean, I'm kind of doing like women's rights and... What's my name saying? Why am I forgetting? I don't know. Immigration, women's rights, I don't know. Redemption.
Have you ever written before?
Yes. So I have a degree in journalism, and I wrote a couple of nonfiction books, memoirs, and I've been a columnist for many, many years, writing about arts, entertainment. I was a dating columnist for an alternative news weekly, at the same time that I was a religion editor for a gay and lesbian newspaper. At the same time, I was the bridal editor, this is all true, for a society, right, this was in Denver. But I really feel like all of those experiences gave me a lot of different insight into a lot of different perspectives, because I've interviewed so many people over the course of my career.
What happened in St. Petersburg?
Sorry?
How did you end up in St. Petersburg?
Well, that's a great question. So when my first book came out in 2014, American Lady Creature, I organized a book tour, which was essentially a couch surfing tour. And my aunt and uncle lived down here. Even though they weren't here when I grew up, my grandfather lived in St. Petersburg. So we used to come here all the time when I was a little kid. And I had this idea in my head that all of St. Petersburg smelled like sulfur. Do you remember? So nobody remembers that. And when I was coming for the book tour, I thought, oh, okay, just fuck up. It's going to be fine. It was not there anymore. They fixed it. Anyway, and I found out that they did actually fix it, because I'm that person, I was going to find out. Anyway, I came here on a book tour, and the literary community here is amazing. It's really welcoming, warm, friendly, and active. I've been living in New York City. I had a rental place in Pittsburgh, so the idea was, I'm going to buy a rental place in St. Pete, but I'll end up going back to New York after I buy it and fix it up and rent it out. And I met that guy right there. Look at him!
That guy?
How could I not marry him? Yes.
This guy.
So that's why I ended up staying in St. Pete. But that's why I first came here, was for a book tour. And I was really, on that book tour, I was sort of thinking, okay, I gotta sell this house in Pittsburgh that I've been renting out for many years because my mom had passed away. And I was like, I'm never going back. I hate the cold weather. Now, let's face it, in New York, it gets cold, but every two stores, you can stop in and shop for something or get a coffee. Like, it doesn't feel the same as when you're, like, crossing the tundra in the middle of nowhere. Yes.
How long did it take you to write?
Oh, a long time. So I started this book. Well, the idea for this book, like I said, it first came to me when I saw that photograph, and that was in 2018. And the reason I remember that is because I told a writer, a friend of mine, about it, and she was so excited. She said, oh my gosh, you gotta write that, you gotta get that out. Well, I had another book that I was working on, and I was like, I can't pick up two books at the same time. They were very different. And so I put it on the back burner. And also, I wasn't sure, even though I started off writing fiction, like the journalism was just like, this is my day job. This is how I'm gonna make money. But I, you know, fiction, who's gonna make any money at that? So I started writing nonfiction, but I would, you know, submit stories to literary journals and things like that. And then life events conspired when I moved to Qatar in the Persian Gulf and got a job there to try to help my husband's journalism career at the time, and then he ended up leaving. Not him. No, my God, he's had that
different.
He got on a plane and went home, and then called me and told me he wanted a divorce. And I was like, what? And I'm stuck in Qatar with your dogs? What? I know. Who leaves their dogs? Cold. Anyway,
wrote a book about it.
So I actually had intended to write a series of like witty essays, because Qatar is a super weird place. Like, women are wrapped head to toe in black, and they sort of float through the malls and ask Victoria's Secret ads. So weird.
Sorry.
No, but it's, I mean, you gotta laugh, right? That would have been a fun book.
It's terrible.
That would have been a very fun book to write. But what happened was, I mean, this may be TMI, but I'm a memoirist, so here we go. I went through early menopause when I was in there. I was 38 years old, and I go to the doctor, and I'm sweating, I'm hot, I'm cranky, I'm like, God, I hate this place. It's hot. Well, it turns out I was in menopause, and I was like, what? So I had to rediscover who I was as a woman whose husband had just left her, and I'm in the world's most patriarchal culture. Hello, that's gotta be a memoir. Like, I can't write that as like witty essays. I don't know, it just didn't feel right to me, because what I really discovered was how I internalized misogyny, and that living there was a process of really working through that. I don't know,
so I think I had...
I'm so sorry. I started it in 2018. I worked on it during NaNoWriMo. I don't know if you're familiar with that, what that is. It's National Novel Writing Month. So you spend a month and you're like, I'm going to type 1,500 words a day, so that at the end of it you have a terrible novel. And I maybe got 35,000 words. That was probably the first 8 chapters that I wrote where it was from the men's perspective. And then when the pandemic hit and we were locked in, I thought, well, I'm never going to figure out if I can write a novel. Now's the time. So I started it in 2020. I had my other book come out in 2020. You know, my second memoir came out in 2023. So, you know, there was some stops and starts. So I worked on it for probably a year solid, and then it was in the editorial process for another year. But I started working on Vegas Girls a year ago. So I'm trying to expedite that editing process and get it out by November of this year.
That's actually not that long.
I know. What? Well, 5 years?
I mean, it seems like it, but it
feels like a long
20
time.
If you were focusing on only that, and that's all you.
Well,
yes.
That's, right.
That's not a long time.
Thank you for saying that. Any questions about these weirdos that I just talked about?
No, I have a bizarre question.
A bizarre question?
How do you normally dress, or is this a reflection of the book?
No, this is a reflection of the book. Although I have always loved 40s style. One of my fond memories from childhood is watching those old black and white movies with my mom. Those women, they're like kicking back the whiskey and they're smoking, and they always had a witty answer for everything. And they were just my idols. And I did as a child paint my nails. I grew my nails long, like I was a 40s film star. And I would paint them in these garish colors. I look back at pictures of myself and think, how did my parents, they were just like, all right, that's fine. Oh, the 70s.